A very good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is Freedom of Religion against Nicholson. Mr. Bolton.
Thank you, Your Honor. One of the things that has been developing in this area of the First Amendment as it relates to the government's interaction with religion has to do with it used to be the cases that you would essentially see on the First Amendment related to nativity scenes or monuments or displays. What we're starting to see in the cases now is situations where the government and its relationship to social service programs is at issue in terms of what is the proper limit for government in terms of substantively providing social service programs or various programs of entitlement that incorporate religion. One of the ironies to me is that in many respects the arguments that the government or in other governments make is that it is easier to get a nativity scene removed than to prohibit the government from substantively providing programs of substantive religious content. And the reason I find that to be somewhat ironic is because in many respects the concerns of the Establishment Clause are certainly every bit as much implicated, and in many respects more seriously implicated by programs that social service programs that substantively incorporate religion. That's background to the present case. An area in which I've certainly seen that happen is in the area of health care. Today's lawsuit involves the VA health care system and the provision of and the adoption of a medical treatment model that actively incorporates religion into the treatment model.
You know,
yes,
we probably should start with standing, I suppose, but because you mentioned the Establishment Clause, there is something I would like to ask you right off the bat, and it's this. In your reply brief, you declared that the Establishment Clause...
I
have a terrible cold, and you...
Well, and on top of it, I really don't hear well, and I'm too stubborn to do anything about
it. I'm going to shriek at you. In your reply brief, you declare that the Establishment Clause precludes the government from directly providing religious services just because such services are believed to be effective in promoting secular objectives such as positive health care outcomes, and that the government may only provide such services when necessary to preserve rights under the Free Exercise Clause. You're with me so far,
yes,
right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, what I've been wondering is, does that mean that the government could not provide programs such as Alcoholics Anonymous with its focus on a higher power, even if that was statistically the most effective rehabilitative program? And
Are you done with the question?
Yeah. Sort of.
Okay. First of all, and I'm not going to dodge your question.
I'm not going to let you.
I understand. I wouldn't want you to. But the AA is a little bit unusual in that typically the AA programs are actually provided by the AA organization and do not charge, so there's usually not the taxpayer issue with AA programs. But I understand the concept that you're asking is if there is a program that you need to pay for that is determined to be the most effective at accomplishing essentially some secular goal. Does the Establishment Clause limit the government in providing that particular program directly? And I think it does.
Okay, then why? Why should it violate the Establishment Clause to provide programs that are the most medically effective, regardless of religious orientation, provided non-religious options were provided as well? Why?
The Establishment Clause, historically, people who have promoted religion and religion in the incorporation of government services have always, I mean, very seldom do the people who have been advocating these, have they subjectively thought that they were doing anything wrong or that their programs were anything but the most effective. The Establishment Clause essentially says we've got to have this separation because otherwise, just as a practical matter, to face the initial question, is this program more effective because it has religion, engages the government in a decision-making process that is very difficult to make. But then you also get into situations where, okay, what if then the most effective program is determined, you know, and I've asked this I've asked this in other cases in depositions where this point is made. Well, the incorporation of religion is more effective than other programs, and we want to provide the most effective program. And I say, well, then surely then you would also be if there is a particular religious program, then surely you would also think that as a public servant you should provide the particular program. And if it's a Lutheran program or a Jewish program, that you should pick that program because you've determined it to be most effective. And I think if you get into those sorts of determinations, that gets us into the area that the Establishment Clause was trying to prevent. So, for instance, you could take this. You know, what I call this is the secularization of the justification for religion.
Except, you see, if services that would promote a positive health outcome aren't allowed solely because they are religious in nature, that promotes non-religion over religion in violation of the Establishment Clause, doesn't it?
No. No, I don't think it does. The notion that the government can directly provide social services that integrate religious content, I think that proposition has been clearly rejected by the Supreme Court. But the practical answer to your question, doesn't that promote non-religion over religion? I think not, because the Establishment Clause, the government doesn't have an obligation to provide or not provide religion. And so to not provide a faith-based service, I mean, essentially what you're saying is that if you provide non-faith-based services, then isn't it a violation of the Establishment Clause to not also provide in your menu of services faith-based programs, because to not include everything on the grocery shelf would reflect a disapproval of religion. But the fact of the matter is that the Establishment Clause doesn't prohibit providing non-religious programming. And so the question is, can the government include in its social service programs faith-based programs? And I think that the answer to that is through a long line of Supreme Court decisions, and even people, even Supreme Court justices who have not been friendly to Establishment Clause cases, have recognized that the issues and the dangers in government directly providing social service programs. It's very different. And so I think the answer is it does not disadvantage or reflect disapproval of religion. Because the irony, of course, would be to say that the Establishment Clause doesn't prohibit government from providing faith-based services. The argument would be that actually the Establishment Clause requires that you provide faith-based services. And I think that turns the Establishment Clause on its ear. But more importantly, it gets us into the very sort of decision-making about the relationship between religion and government.
Does it have the discriminatory effect, however, on the patient? The patient who is susceptible to making progress in a faith-based program really is put at a disadvantage.
That could be said. That can be said for, I mean, the justification then would be that government has to pay for directly provide faith-based social services. And the fact of the matter is that if somebody wants a particular, you know, if somebody wants a religious or a faith-based program, the fact that they don't get it through a government entitlement program doesn't mean that they've been discriminated against.
So a veteran has to choose then to go to a private facility as opposed to using the veteran benefit.
But
if the veteran chooses that faith-based service,
that's correct. But let me also caution that we've recognized that in terms of having access, for instance, to chaplaincy services for the people who do not have access to it because of a government detriment, because they're in Iraq or because they're in a hospital and they can't and they simply can't have access. Access to religious services in those situations, obviously, as an accommodation, is allowed. But in terms of providing faith-based programs to other entitlement beneficiaries, those choices do have to be made, and one of the characteristics of an entitlement program is that if you don't want it as it's provided, you can get it through other sources.
In this situation, of course.
Pardon me?
In this situation, however, given the viewpoint of the accrediting organization, that offering these services is the accepted standard of care, aren't you committing the Veterans Administration really to giving substandard care in these areas simply because it is a government organization? And that from your perspective would be acceptable. Is that correct?
That if the accrediting, I'm not sure I did.
Well, the accrediting organization says that a good psychiatric program, shall we say, for post-traumatic stress disorder, is one that includes, in its available services, faith-based therapy. If that is true, and in your view, the Veterans Administration cannot offer that kind of service, you are in effect saying that the Veterans Administration, because of its government character, is required by the Constitution to give a substandard medical service. Is that correct?
No. If that were true, if the accrediting, a private accrediting body said that you had to integrate substantively religion into health care, I don't believe that an accrediting body can override the Constitution.
What it has said is that you have to offer that as one of several options simply because a distinct part of the population will significantly benefit from that.
Let me clarify in terms of what that issue in this case. The joint accrediting body that has been relied upon by the VA in this case does not require the programming that we're objecting to. For instance, we're not talking about this lawsuit raised a number of issues, including not just the spiritual assessments, which they say that the Joint Accrediting Agency requires, but actual treatment programs that are just explicitly. There's one program that is based upon the principles of lament, and the whole notion of the program is that basically they engage it. And I don't mean to be disrespectful, and I may be misstating this aspect of the program, but as I understand from this program, that basically they engage in writing their own prayers, essentially. The Joint Accrediting Body does not require that. And that's one of the issues here, is that that the VA is going beyond what the Joint Accrediting Agency or organization requires. They also provide, and this is a change, this is a philosophical change. They want to provide faith-based programming on an outpatient basis, which has no justification as an accommodation issue, but merely as a model of medical treatment. They think that it is better that as a medical practice that that people have access to this, whether they're outpatients or not. But
they have
outpatient.
Forgive me. They have access, but there's no requirement here.
Pardon?
There's no requirement.
There's no requirement, but again, government actively, directly providing faith-based services, the Supreme Court has said in those situations the government has made a decision. It and gives the appearance that they are endorsing this. But what I was going to say on the outpatient aspect, then, that's not required by the Joint Accrediting Organization, and so really, the argument there related to the concept of spiritual assessments. And we have not criticized the entire notion of spiritual assessments, but in this particular case, we presented examples of actual spiritual assessments that are basically religious inventories, and from which then they determine a spiritual injury index. Now, they'll say, well, we're not using that program, that computer program anymore, but actual hospitals are using these inventories. It is a fact. And when these are presented, some of them actually say on the inventory, on the assessment, we believe that the incorporation or the integration of religion into healthcare model will promote better outcomes, essentially. So they're not just taking the assessment. They're actually giving an indication that we think that this is the way to go, that this is a better alternative. And so the organization, the joint accrediting requirement, does not require substandard care, require the argument that if they couldn't do the things that they're doing, they would be providing substandard care. The joint accrediting organization does not require the programming that the VA has instituted. You will not find, when you go through the briefs, you'll see very specific examples of religious programs that aren't just assessments, but that the actual content of the program is as religious as you can get. The Joint Accrediting Organization does not require these. These are programs that philosophically the VHA has determined are advantageous.
Mr. Bolton, I hate to cut into your merits argument, but I would like to hear your position on standing.
Yes.
I'd like to hear your position on standing. Of course, I've read the briefs. Could you make your best point on standing?
Final point on standing. Heim and Flast and Bowen require essentially that there be a legislative program. The government does not deny that there is a government program. Healthcare benefits to veterans are provided pursuant to a government program. They do not deny that that program is funded by appropriations by Congress. Their argument is that, yes, but the program itself doesn't call for religious content. I think they misapprehend. What's required is a government program that is funded by Congress, And Bowen says that if you have that, the government can avoid the Establishment Clause by simply because they say the program itself was facially constitutional, but it was administered improperly.
Bolton, how do you respond to Hendricks? Because in Hendricks we held that for taxpayers' standing, the challenged expenditures must be expressly authorized or mandated by specific congressional enactment. Where is that specific congressional enactment authorizing the expenditure for the chaplaincy program?
Bowen doesn't say that the legislative program has to mandate the religious content. What you've got in the current, I mean, in the age of administrative programming, obviously Congress delegates most of the administration of all these entitlement programs. But Bowen doesn't say that, Bowen specifically concluded that that the program itself was not facially unconstitutional. It did not require a violation of the Establishment Clause, but as applied. And the argument that, yes, but it has to at least call for some religious content, I don't read Bowen to say that. It says that you have to, or Hine. Hine says you have to have a government program and you have to have funding for that program. But if it's administered in violation of the Establishment Clause, I think you have satisfied the standing requirements. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bolton. Mr. Bolton, you had used your rebuttal time. However, I'm going to give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
So that you can prepare. And, Mr. Sturgill, I will extend your time by 3 minutes as well for your presentation.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Lowell Sturgill from the Department of Justice representing federal defendants. I'd like to begin by addressing standing, because the Court, of course, has to have Article III jurisdiction in order to consider the appeal, and standing is a jurisdictional matter. As our briefs argue, the plaintiffs lack Article III standing in this case based on three decisions that were issued after the district court issued its ruling. One is the Supreme Court's decision in Hine, the second is Heinrichs, which has been mentioned, and the third is the Winkler case, also from this circuit. I'd like to begin with Hine. And again, I'd like to begin by noting that the plaintiffs don't allege that they have traditional Article III standing and that they're injured in a way that would typically satisfy the injury in fact requirements. What they're alleging is only taxpayer standing. The Supreme Court in Hine reiterated that, as a general rule, there is no taxpayer standing to challenge federal action under the Constitution. There's a narrow exception, the Supreme Court explained, under Flast versus Cohen. But the Supreme Court in Hine held that taxpayer standing exists only where the challenged expenditures were expressly authorized or mandated by a specific congressional appropriation. Here, we don't have any of those elements satisfied. For example, if you look at the funding statute, the most recent one, which we sent in a 28J letter, if you look through that funding statute, what you'll see is a lump sum general appropriation for the work of the Veterans Administration and the Veterans Health Administration. You'll find no reference whatsoever to chaplains, and you'll even more so find no reference at all to the particular aspects of the VA chaplain program that the plaintiffs are challenging.
Well, what do you think would be enough for taxpayers standing here? Would the appropriation have to mention, chaplain program by name? Would that be enough, even if the, let's say, the unconstitutional actions under the program were not anticipated by the Congress?
I think you can gain guidance both from Heinrichs and from the Supreme Court's decision in Hine itself. If you look at footnote 7 in Hine, footnotes they taught us in law school are very important, and I think they are in this case, because in that case the Supreme Court said that even if you had a case where there was legislative history, where a congressional committee had specifically said that it anticipated that federal money would be given to a religious organization, that would not be sufficient to create Article III standing. It has to be in the statute. It has to be a specific reference to the religious organization and to the particular use of the money. For example, I'm sorry. If I could just follow up, the plaintiffs rely on Bowen versus Kendrick. But if you look at the statute in Kendrick, the Kendrick statute specifically said, and it directed the federal agencies to provide funding to religious organizations, among other organizations. So the requirement that Hine has set out was satisfied in the Kendrick case, but is not satisfied in this case. I cut you off.
I wonder if we should be worrying about the fact that if there's no taxpayer standing in this case, where you have a large expenditure, and the program was clearly within the parameters of the appropriation, although not mentioned by name. In effect, aren't we really holding that those individuals who administer most programs, they're going to be totally immune to taxpayer scrutiny?
Well, I think not. I think, first of all, to the extent that's the case, the Supreme Court considered that in the Hine case. And in particular, if you look at footnote 7, the court didn't seem to be concerned about that. I think there are two reasons for that. One is that the court has made clear now that it really does view tax establishment clause taxpayer standing as a narrow doctrine. In fact, if you look at the court's opinion, it said expressly that it has narrowed that doctrine to the facts and results of FLAST itself. Well, we know what that means. That means that the doctrine, the court views it as essentially inoperable other than the very, very narrow circumstances in that case. And second, I think it's important to note that, especially in this kind of case, there probably will be parties who would suffer traditional Article III injury who could sue to challenge what the Secretary is doing if there were a case where the Secretary were clearly violating the Establishment Clause. For example, you have a case, Baz versus Walters, where there was an unusual situation. It's a Title VII case where the VA itself found that one of its chaplains was illegally proselytizing. Well, then the VA took the appropriate action. It fired the employee. The employee brought an action, and this court upheld the VA's his action. So there you have a case, again, where the person wasn't allowed to get away with something. And so if you had a situation where, let's say, a chaplain was proselytizing in an unconstitutional manner, you'd have somebody who could sue the person who had been inappropriately contacted.
What state was that in?
Well, I have the opinion.
Well, don't waste time.
If I could have 7 seconds. Illinois.
Illinois.
The case was from the Central District of Illinois, so I assume that was.
Thank you.
So I think, in sum, then, based on the Hine case, you lack what was necessary there. And Heinrichs, if there was any doubt about this proposition after Heinrichs, I think it's just absolutely clear, because in Heinrichs, the court followed up and applied Hine in a situation where the court said there was no taxpayer standing to challenge the content of legislative prayers in the Indiana House. And in that case, it was notable that the court noted that there were expenditures that were involved that the House was aware of, expenditures on thank you letters to the clergy who were coming in and praying and invitation letters. And what the court said was, that had nothing to do with what the plaintiffs were arguing. The plaintiffs in that case were challenging the content of the legislative prayers. And the court said in that case that there was no taxpayer standing because there was no money spent on that aspect of what the plaintiffs were challenging. Well, that's the case here. If the government, just because the government is spending money on the salaries of chaplains, has nothing to do with the plaintiffs, what the plaintiffs are arguing. They don't argue. In fact, they concede that the VA can have chaplains. What they're arguing is how they don't like how the VA is using its chaplains. But as they also concede in their brief, the question of how the VA is using its chaplains, what it's directing them to do, well, that was decided by the VA, not by Congress. And in Heinrichs, the court said, again, how the Indiana speaker decides to runs its prayer practice, well, that's a matter of the speaker's discretion, nothing that the Indiana legislature itself had mandated, and you have the same thing here. For those two reasons, then, based on Hine and Heinrichs, we think the court clearly lacks standing, taxpayer standing in this case.
Mr. Sturgill, standing wasn't argued in front of Judge Shabazz, was it?
It was not.
And was that because the Hine case was decided after?
It was.
Did you feel your position on standing improved considerably after the Hine case?
Well, if you look at the Heinrichs decision itself, Heinrichs explained that Hine significantly clarified the law of taxpayer standing in a way that I think makes it absolutely clear that there is standing here. Before Hine, the prevailing circuit precedent was the Court of Appeals opinion in Hine, which, of course, we had lost. And I guess a judgment was made by those who were litigating the case in the district court that it would not be worth raising the issue at that point. But it's clear from the law that standing is Article 3 matter, and it can be addressed at any point by a court, and it can't be waived. Just to briefly, again, talk about the Winkler case. The plaintiffs lack taxpayer standing here for a completely different reason than we've just talked about. In Winkler, the Supreme Court, this court held that the plaintiffs lacked taxpayer standing to challenge the Secretary of Defense's support of the Boy Scout Jamboree pursuant to a statute. And what the court held was that taxpayer standing under the Establishment Clause is present only where the government's action is solely justified by the Taxing and Spending Clause. And what the court held in Winkler was that the government's support of the Jamboree was also supported by the Constitution's military clauses, because the support of the Jamboree served a military purpose. Well, here you have precisely the same scenario. As we've pointed out in our brief, it's critical that we have the military context here. VA hospitals serve people who are veterans, who have had military service. And in fact, beyond that, they actually serve, to some degree, active duty soldiers. They're active duty soldiers who have served in Iraq and in Afghanistan, who are being treated in VA hospitals right now. So you have a program that, similar to the program in Winkler, is supported by the Constitution's military clauses.
These are people who have not yet been discharged on disability.
That's correct.
Is this a new development?
No, it's always been the case. There's a federal statute that authorizes the VA to treat active duty soldiers. It's listed in my brief, and I don't have the citation.
But we'll find it easily enough, yes.
Yeah, there's a statute, and it's a longstanding statute. So again, this is a case in which you have authority from the Constitution other than the Taxing and Spending Clause. United States versus Oregon is cited in our brief. There, the court expressly held that Congress has power under the military clauses to provide hospitals for veterans. And it's pretty obvious, too, and there's case law to support the fact that free medical care for veterans is a significant incentive to service and essential to the recruitment and retention of soldiers. And second, I would note also that in this case, as in Winkler, what the VA is doing here primarily is regulating its own manpower. So this isn't really a taxing and spending scenario at all. This isn't money going out from the government to fund programs. In Winkler, the court made the point that in that case, what the Secretary of Defense was doing was basically regulating its own manpower. It was authorizing soldiers to take their time, their official time, and help support the Jamboree. Well, here you have the same exact kind of thing. You've got the VA regulating its manpower by determining how VA chaplains are going to spend their time on the job. So for those two reasons, this second line of authority represented by Winkler also independently shows that the plaintiffs lack Article III standing to bring this case. If there are no other questions on that, I'd like to turn to the merits. And on the merits, one preliminary point before getting into the specifics, and that is that the Eighth Circuit in Carter versus Broadlawns rejected what is essentially a similar and identical challenge to what the VA is doing with its chaplains. It rejected an establishment clause argument in a scenario in which the plaintiffs were arguing, as the plaintiffs do here, that VA chaplains should not be allowed to be integrated into the overall medical care program of a hospital. So I think you can just affirm on the merits, if you reach the merits, for the reasons that the Eighth Circuit has given us in the Carter case. But if you want to go beyond that, I think the best way to look at the merits is to look at the three types of actions that chaplains carry out in hospitals. And this is set out in Mr. Etheridge's declaration. The first thing they do is accommodate patients' free exercise of religion needs. They do that by conducting worship services for patients, for those who voluntarily want to attend, to obtaining religious books, providing counseling, and that kind of thing, which is the sorts of activities that VA and military chaplains have engaged in since the very beginning of the Republic, as we pointed out in our brief. What the plaintiffs argue in this respect is that it's not permissible for the VA to do this sort, provide these sorts of services for outpatients. And their argument is outpatients don't have any kind of a burden, a government-imposed burden, on their free exercise rights that the government is entitled to accommodate. Well, they're wrong about that for a number of reasons. First of all, as our brief explains, the VA, similar to the private healthcare industry, is now following a model of healthcare that stresses continuity of care, where patients are encouraged to be released from the hospital early and be treated at home, but then they might have to come back for further treatment, and you have a system which there are relationships that are developed between patients and their doctors, patients and their counselors and their chaplains, for example. So you can have a scenario under the plaintiff's view of the case where, let's say, a veteran could come into a military hospital with a service-connected injury, a war wound, that has created serious problems. He sees a chaplain. He chooses to see a chaplain and is receiving chaplain services that are essential, he believes, to meeting his needs. Then he's released to go home. And suddenly, under the plaintiff's view, that relationship has to be completely severed so that he can't speak to that chaplain again, even though he may be back in the VA hospital the next week or the next month. We don't know. Yes, Judge?
If studies showed that students progressed more quickly when religious values were part of the curriculum, could the government constitutionally teach religion in schools or in their after program and in their after programs to further its educational mission?
I don't think so under the current view of the law, and I think why that's different, and this is the big mistake that plaintiffs make. The Supreme Court has said on numerous occasions that the Establishment Clause is context specific. What we have in this case is the military context. We have a voluntary program that is provided in a context where the plaintiffs themselves concede that the military is allowed to provide chaplains to do things like engage in worship services, to write liturgy, and to conduct inherently religious worship services for patients who request that kind of activity. So I think to decide this case, if you reach the merits, you don't have to, and you shouldn't go beyond the military context, because we don't know what the answer might be in a different context, and you don't want to be, trying to make a judgment about how those factors would play out. So again, I think this is the military context, and the court should limit itself to that.
In other words, the government, in effect, has done something to these individuals which has deprived them at some point in their life of or injured them in some way in their life in a way that can be and best remedied by this religiously based therapies.
That's right. We're dealing here.
Their experience and their earlier contact with the government that makes the difference.
That's right. And the notion that also that chaplains, VA chaplains, are specially trained to provide services to address the unique and special healthcare needs and psychological needs that soldiers can have. You have soldiers who have, and veterans who have post-traumatic stress syndrome, soldiers who were dealing with the fact that they may have had to kill or take the life of others, soldiers seeing their fellow soldiers die in combat. These are unique sorts of present unique sorts of situations that the VA especially trains its chaplains to address. And the notion that that these veterans can, you know, down the street find a similar kind of treatment is not supported in the record, and it flies against what the record does show about the unique sorts of needs that they have and the extent to which the VA has gone to meet those needs. And I think it is the case, as the court had pointed out in the opening argument, that if you take plaintiff's case, it reduces to the notion that the Establishment Clause requires the government to provide substandard health care to those among us who, if anything, should be entitled to the best health care that is available. These are people who have put their lives on the line for the nation and many times have come back with serious physical and psychological injuries. And to require that they not be given, that they be given substandard health care is odd indeed. I think it flies against the face of what this court held in the McCallum case, which concerned a different kind of program. But if you read that opinion, you can't reach that result from there. Second, the VA chaplains help protect patients from having religion imposed on them. They're there to ensure that, for example, sometimes visitors to hospitals, clergy come in and want to proselytize patients, and the VA chaplains intercede on behalf of the patients to prevent that. And finally, they provide pastoral counseling to all patients. The VA program trains its chaplains to provide compassionate care to anybody. What this involves is exactly what you would think it involves. It involves visitation, going to see a patient, asking how the patient is doing, and allowing the patient to direct the conversation so that if the patient doesn't want to talk about or doesn't raise any kind of religious or spiritual matters, the chaplain won't either. But if the patient says that they have a religious need, well, then the chaplain may address that, but only because the patient has requested it. And in a scenario in which the chaplain can hold worship services down the hall on that Sunday for anybody, for the very same person who wants to come. So, again, in this kind of a particular setting, the plaintiff's case doesn't make any sense. They've challenged the spiritual, they call them spiritual assessments or screenings, that go on when patients enter hospitals. There are two sorts of screenings. There's an initial screening. And at that point, this is to comply with what the accrediting organization requires. The accrediting organization requires hospitals, similar to every private hospital in the country, to honor and respect the patient's religious needs. A patient might have, for example, dietary needs, or may want to see a chaplain. And to deny that kind of request in any kind of a setting, private or public, is not the provision of standard health care. So the VA has an initial screening, which just asks questions like, do you have any religious needs? Do you have a religious affiliation? Do you want to speak to a chaplain? These forms are voluntary. You don't have to answer yes to any of this. And if you don't want to see a chaplain, you won't see one. Well, then there's a second screening, a more in-depth screening, which the plaintiffs focus on more specifically. Well, these are left to basically, they're developed by the chaplains at the individual facilities. And as you might expect, these are given to patients who have requested a chaplain. Say a patient on the initial screen, yes, I'd like to see a chaplain. Well, then the chaplain gives them the next screening to say, well, what sorts of things are you interested in? What do you need? What's your religious denomination? And it's a clearly a more in-depth request for information, but only in response to the plaintiff's own request, and only to allow the chaplain to do his job of meeting whatever needs the patient has. So that I just don't see anything unconstitutional about that kind of a procedure. And the Eighth Circuit in the Carter case rejected the notion that that could be an Establishment Clause violation. They called it a necessary accoutrement of the fact that you have chaplains at all. And then finally, I note that the chaplains serve as a link, an essential link between veterans and doctors. They will listen to what the veterans are saying and translate that and tell that to the doctors if they need to know it. For example, there's one example in the Etheridge Declaration where you had a Native American patient who was languishing in the hospital and not getting better. Well, the chaplain talked to him and listened to him and found out he believed he needed to be at home in a sacred site to feel better. Well, the chaplain then told the doctors and nurses that. They released the patient. The patient went home and got better. Well, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. That's the kind of integration we're talking about here. And to have a system where the chaplains can't talk to the doctors doesn't make any sense, doesn't do any good for any of the patients, and is not required by the Establishment Clause. My time is up, and I would just summarize then by saying there's no taxpayer standing here, and to reverse the district court would radically restrict what the VA chaplains are doing in a time in which that is particularly unwise. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sturgill. Mr. Bolton.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate your indulgence in rebuttal time. In regard to standing, I addressed Hine. The government and I disagree on the reading of Hine. I will note that Hine is distinct from this case, and that was really the major debating point in the argument in the Supreme Court. Hine involved programs that were created by executive order, the conferences that were at issue. And so the government was using funds that it received from Congress, but there was not a congressional program implicated. And similarly, in this court's Heinrich's decision with the legislative prayer, this court concluded that there was not actually a legislative program that had been statutorily adopted in that case. So Heinrich's does not speak to the issue that we have in this case, where the government does not tell you that there is not a legislative program mandating the medical services at issue. Winkler was... I read Winkler, and the court went through a careful evaluation trying to determine is this essentially a spending program such as FLAST, or is it something else such as, and they compared, they evaluated is it more like FLAST or more like Valley Forge? Valley Forge was where they had given away some I think it was a hospital or some property that they didn't need, and the court concluded that. That in Winkler that the support for the Jamboree was not essentially a spending program and in fact said that the program was specifically set up essentially to be revenue neutral. Nobody can argue, and certainly the government does not argue, that health care benefits to veterans is not a traditional spending program such as we had at issue in FLAST. On the merits, I would simply say that the government is essentially trying to set up to create essentially special needs categories in which the government can provide faith-based programs to certain categories of individuals, such as veterans. They say veterans are a unique class of people, so the government should be able to provide and integrate religion differently than for other persons. There are other categories of special needs. For instance, prisoners are treated in the same fashion, that they would benefit from more religion. And the Eighth Circuit just recently said that in a case involving Iowa and the Americans United challenge to that program, that even if you believe that that program is the gall-darn best one, the Establishment Clause doesn't allow the government to directly provide that type of faith-based religious programming. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.